This is June the 3rd, 2004. And my name's Arthur Eggers, and we're looking to 2 Corinthians chapter 12 tonight. It is not expedient for me, doubtlessly, to glory. I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. The word expedient comes from a word that means to be profitable. He did glory some in chapter before this, and it's possible that Paul had to stop writing when he began again. There was a lull there, is what I want to say, when he began again, and he had thought a bit about what he had written before. I don't know anyone who had more visions and revelations than the Apostle Paul. God had revealed so many things to him that he didn't reveal to anyone else. The word vision is God's revealing himself when one is awake. We remember Peter when he was on the housetop in Acts 10, and God gave him a vision. He was awake. God gave him a vision of the sheep being let down. Dreams are a little bit different, I believe. A person is probably asleep during a dream, and there is a kind of a difference there. Anyway, the word revelation here is an interesting word. It means, it's from the Greek word apocalypse, which we had a word revelation. It means to take the lid off of something, to unveil something, to uncover something. From the day Paul was struck down on the road to Damascus until the last day of his life, God revealed himself to Paul. So rather than glorying in himself, he gloried in the vision. Wouldn't take any glory to himself. In verse 2, let's read 2 through 5. I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago, whether in the body, I cannot tell, or whether out of the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. Such a one is caught up into the third heaven. And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. How that he was caught up into the paradise and heard unspeakable words which are not lawful for a man to utter. Of such a one will I glory, yet of myself I will not glory, but in mine own infirmities. And I believe that God was speaking of himself in this story about a man that he knew, and he would know yourself better than anybody else would know you. In the first place, the Greek word for knew should be translated to know. It's the Greek word oidos. Oida, there in this case, perfect tense, present meaning, and should be translated to say, I know. And it's kin to the word to see, which means to know because you've seen something, because of experience. And so the thought here of the word know, as he's laid out, is to know something without any doubt whatsoever in your mind. This is it. A deeper meaning than just a simple, I knew a man. So Paul was in Acts 14, verses 19 to 20, Paul was stoned to death. And we read there that there came thither certain Jews from Antioch, Iconium, who persecuted the people. And having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing that he had been dead. Howbeit, when the disciples stood around about him, he rose up and came into the city, and the next day he departed with Barnabas to Derbe. So this was about 14 years before this happened here. So it is possible that Paul may have died at this time. And while he was dead, God gave him a vision of heaven. Now there are stories today of people who die, then they recuperate, and then they tell of heaven, visions of heaven. I doubt some of them. In fact, I doubt all of them when the stories that you hear have a description of earthly things, such as they say, oh, I went to heaven and I saw beautiful flowers and this and that. There's no natural things in heaven whatsoever. Possibly they had a vision of some kind. I don't know. But I don't think they went to heaven. See, some of them say, I saw a light through the end of a tunnel. Now, I can believe that a lot better than I could. It's beautiful trees. These are all with the natural mind. So 14 years ago would have been about the right timing for this to happen. And one thing that he didn't know, or he didn't hear, or one thing he didn't know, was that whether he was in a body or out of a body. Now, we read in 2 Corinthians 5 that when we leave this body, we depart and be with Christ. He didn't know, and I was thinking about this, that will it make that much difference to us anyway? Whether we have a body or whether we don't have a body, it may after we're there for a while, but I think the main thing is to see and hear beautiful things. See Jesus, that would be the most important thing that I can think of in leaving this body. But when this earthly body is destroyed, we read that we have another house, made without hands, eternal in heaven. Evidently, Paul wasn't going to be there long enough to get a house. But he just didn't know if he had any kind of a body or not. Yeah, the word oida is used in every one of these different statements that he was not sure of, too. The third heavens that we read of here speak of, in this verse, causes us to believe of a second, that there must be a second and a third heaven. If there's a third, you don't get the tree without going through one and two, do you? We believe that there's more than one heavens. We have the first heaven is the atmosphere, the clouds, the birds fly into heaven. Then the second heaven would be the planetary heavens, solar systems and all those things. And then the third heaven would be the throne of God, where he takes his abode. The word paradise here is an interesting word too. It comes from a compound Greek word of para, which means around something, round about, and the word tetlos is it has a mean of to build a wall. So to put the two together, we have a wall built around something, is the thought of the word paradise. We could call this a walled garden or a walled park. In the Septuagint we have the same thought in the Garden of Eden. In the Songs of Solomon we have this thought in the Greek word used there in the Septuagint is used referring to a garden. In Luke 23 there's a prophecy that Jesus made to the thief on the cross. He said, "Today thou shalt be with me in paradise." So if the Garden of Eden was paradise at the time God put it there, Jesus said that it was in the heart of the earth, or the bowels of the earth. Sin moved it from the Garden of Eden to the bowels of the earth, because he told Adam that the day you eat, thou shalt surely die. And so he was taken out of the garden. But Jesus said it was in the heart of the earth. When Jesus arose from the grave, the paradise was taken up with him, and it was a wonderful place. He said, "This day," he told the thief, "shall thou be with me in paradise." So we also know that Jesus was taken into the heart of the earth, and he also said, as Jonah was in the belly of the whale 3 days and three nights, so shall the Son of Man be in the heart or the bowels of the earth. Now, so this would put paradise in the heart of the earth. Ephesians 4, to read that, that when Jesus arose, that he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. So this took paradise out of the heart of the earth, was established then in the third heaven. And then we all know the verse in the 27th chapter of Matthew, how that some were seen. I think it speaks there of those that were established in the third heaven were later seen walking the streets in Jerusalem. It's called the holy city there. The heart of the earth, we know, is the same as Abraham's bosom, because we read in Luke 16, 19 and 20, that the beggar went into paradise, the rich man went into hell, and paradise was then in the next to hell. There was a gulf fixed between. That was before the resurrection of Christ. After Christ rose, then paradise was taken out, leaving hell in the lower Sheol, we'll call it that, in the heart of the earth. But anyway, we see paradise Amalekite our lesson in the third heavens. Well, we read here that he heard words not lawful or not permissible for man to repeat. He wasn't allowed to repeat the things that he heard. I don't know whether it was just to the Corinthians he made this mention, and they were too young to understand, young spiritually to understand, or what. All right, verse 6. For where I would desire to glory, I shall not be a fool. I will say the truth, but now I forbear, lest any man should think of me above that which he seeth me to be, or that he heareth me to be. And here it seems as though Paul was being pulled in two directions of what he would desire and what he would exalt in the flesh. Sometimes people will force us to say things that we don't want to say, and we get pulled one way or the other. But people might look upon Paul if he had told his vision and said, I went to heaven and I saw and I heard unspeakable things that I'm not allowed to utter. So we pull it in to second person plural. No, second person singular, I'm sorry. Paul here simply wanted to be himself. He didn't want people looking up to him. And a lot of people probably wouldn't have believed him if he told the truth. And there's some things that we keep to ourselves and don't tell people some of the things that God really reveals to us. Like, for instance, you don't tell people you died 2,000 years ago. It's the truth, isn't it? There's some people you wouldn't say that. He stated the fact that he was an apostle, but it was not something that he needed to be filled up above what they heard. In Romans 12, I don't know the verse, but he says, for a man not to think of himself more highly than he ought. I think that's about verse 4, if I remember. More highly than he ought to think of himself. If the modern day preachers today would go to heaven and come back, I don't think they would do as much boasting in themselves as they do. I think they'd be much more humble in themselves than they are. I think we should be lifted up according to our spiritual maturity, is how God will exalt us in eternity, according to how much of the word are we taking in. Along the same line, he said in 1 Corinthians 13, and he said, when I was a child, I thought as a child, and when I became a man, he thought as a man. He put away childish things. He thought more in a spiritual sense when he was grew up spiritually. As we grew in the natural, as we grow up, we think more in a natural ability. So is it in the spiritual. Verse 7, and at least I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of revelation. There was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. Now I think here he proved that he was talking about himself. I think the man, here is proof that in the man in verse 2 was Paul. I know of no one else that would need a thorn in the flesh above what his revelations would be other than Paul himself. The fact that he did see, or hear, I should say, not see, but hear these exalting things, wonderful things. No one else could abound in revelation than anyone that had gone to heaven and come back. So the word abundance here is the same as we read in chapter 4, exceedingly abundantly above, or exceedingly, for our light afflictions, which were but for a moment, are far more exceeding and eternal. Here we have this, the abundance is the same word as we had for exceeding there, hyperbole. There's just not a word that can be measured, that can measure the abundance of Paul's revelations. And that's how many he had. And these would have a tendency to lift up a person. And so we read here that God allowed Satan to give him, to buffet him, I'll put it that way. We don't know what the thorn in his flesh was. Some speculate that he was a hunchback from many beatings that he had had. Others seem to think that he might be blinded, or most partially blinded anyway, I should say, from seeing Jesus on the road to Damascus. Seemed like he might have had weak eyes, never completely recovered from that. But no one really knows. We do know the purpose of it was because of the revelation. It seems like he told us, his saints in Galatia, saints, that they would gladly give him their eyes, which kind of caused people to lean in that direction. But we don't know. But none of us can enter into the same abundance of revelation that Paul had. So we don't need as much thorn in the flesh to keep us humble as Paul needed. There's a difference in a new revelation and a revelation that's already been expounded in the Word of God. Sometimes you get reading the Word and God gives you a revelation of what the Bible says, but it isn't a new revelation. There's no such thing today as a new revelation. It's all been fulfilled. Paul wrote this to the Colossians that you filled up the Word. And so there's nothing new to add to the Bible at all. It's filled up. But God does reveal wonderful things to us. He takes His Word and touches our heart and our mind. But none of us ever went to heaven and heard unspeakable things. We may have some kind of a thorn in the flesh for a time, but it's not for the same purpose. We need to know our weakness, and God allows things to come in our life to show us that we are weak. But for Paul, God allowed a messenger of Satan. I won't say that all things that God allows in our life is from Satan. I think sometimes we give Satan too much credit for things, and I'd rather give credit to the Lord than to give it to him. In this case, we read that a messenger of Satan came and buffeted him. And this worked good in Paul's life. When the human spirit is buffeted, we want to do, what shall I say, we want to do anything we can, I guess, to get out of the hurt. We want to make it easy, don't we? But there was nothing Paul could do. Today, well, we get some little something, we run to the hospital, or run here and there, and sometimes I think that we've just prolonged some of the agony that God would have healed much sooner if we just trusted him. So, but I'm not saying all sicknesses and things that come into our life is a thorn in the flesh. Neither do we say that sickness in our life is a buffeting of God or a chastisement of any kind. Sometimes the Lord just wants to talk to us. It's His grace that's doing it. But when the whole human spirit is buffeted, we don't take it too easy, do we? And so Paul wanted to do something about it. So what did he do? He prayed. He prayed three times, read here, that this would be taken from him. And God said, my grace is sufficient for you. You might notice that Paul called it a thorn. That's interesting, isn't it? A thorn is hurtful. I remember when I lived in Arkansas, we had these locust trees. And they had these big, long thorns. Of course, in the summertime, I wasn't allowed shoes. My shoes were for winter. And so I'd get these locust thorns in my feet, and sometimes they'd fester up, and well, it'd really be hurt for a long time. But I looked in W. Vine, in his dictionary, Paul's language indicates that it was physical, painful, and humiliating. Vine is really usually pretty good on Greek words. But the verb rendered here, that I should not be exalted, overmuch exalted, and to buffet are in this, both of these thoughts are in the present tense, signifying a recurrent action, I should say, or we might say a constant repeating attack over and over again of this, the way it's laid out in a Greek text. All right, verse 8 and 9. For this thing I besought the Lord, that it might depart from me. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, would I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may be upon me. And I think it was obviously something that we know or feel that by God, or at least Paul thought that God would take it from him. But God didn't. See, that was out of lack of faith? No, it wasn't. I think he really believed God for it. But God didn't answer his prayer, did he? And I've often said, and you've heard it over and over again, that God always answers prayer. But this time he said no. That was an answer, wasn't it? Said, no, we're not going to. My grace is sufficient for you. And we know that the grace of God is sufficient for anything. His grace should be sufficient for us also. The word perfect in this verse here is to be fully developed. And he's saying that he understood then what God was doing. It's extremely difficult to glory in our weaknesses and our infirmities unless we understand the purpose God has allowed them to be in our life. And then we could endure them, I guess I should say, more easy when we understand. Can we understand why God does things in our life? I think when we mature, we can, because we know that God's not going to allow anything in our life that isn't going to build us up spiritually. He's just not going to allow it. So if something comes in our life, we learn to take it from his hand, and we learn that God is doing a wonderful work through whatever it is. He's going to get glory out of it. So we know the purpose why things come in our life, don't we? So we should be able to endure them. And if his grace is sufficient, then this is fine. But we don't like these infirmities and these weaknesses. I don't like to wear glasses, but I have an infirmity, a weakness of the flesh. I have a false tooth. I hate it. I don't wear it half the time. I don't have another lot. It's an infirmity of the flesh, and we all have these weaknesses. So we learn to take our things from the hand of the Lord and to glory in them. Paul said, I would rather boast in my weaknesses, glory in my weakness. He can know that God's power is there to watch over him and overshadow him no matter what comes. I think one of the hardest things for people to learn is God does not need our strength. He doesn't need our wisdom, our talents, our abilities. He doesn't need anything we have. He gives them to us for his pleasure, not for ours. If he gives you a good voice, then he gives it to you for his pleasure, and not for your pleasure to sing. So we need to learn this fact. He will use our talents, there's no doubt about it. But he doesn't need them. He'll show his power off at anybody. And I could give you some illustrations, but I won't take time to do that. Verse 10. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecution and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then am I strong. Now this is a hard thing to say, that you take pleasure in whatever our weaknesses might bring. Not only do you endure them, but he says, I take pleasure in my infirmities, in my reproaches. Do you ever take pleasure when people reproach you? And say, oh, thank you for that reproach. No, not in the flesh we don't, but we can if we know it's working for our good, can't we? And the necessities that come in our life, persecutions, distresses, these things just builds us up in strength, doesn't it? And so if we're going to do that, we can take pleasure in them. You know, the insults people say, things that people say that just hurt, just cut us back and hurt our feelings terribly. Paul said he was stoned, but sometimes I think words hurt worse than rocks. But he's going to take care of us and take us down the road and keep us from stumbling over what people do. People feel terrible in the flesh that they cause us to get discouraged. But we don't need to be discouraged. So we take things from his hand. We need to learn that everything is done for Christ's sake. And so here we read that Paul says that if we suffer, and this is in 8th chapter of Romans, if we suffer with him, we shall also be glorified together. I think the word with him there could be understood. And then, because who else do we want to be glorified with other than Christ? So if we suffer with him, the next time something comes in your life, just remember, Paul took these things in behalf of Christ, and we should be able to too. When I am weak, then am I strong. Many of God's ministers have never learned their weakness, so they never learn God's strength. If we don't learn our own weakness, we can't learn the strength of God by knowledge. And from this, Paul could say, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. We can't say that if we don't learn his strength, and we can't learn our strength without going into weakness. And that's where our strength lies, is in him and not in ourselves. Verse 11, I'm become full and growing, yet you have compelled me, for I ought to have been commended of you, for in nothing am I behind the very chiefest apostles, though I be nothing. The reason he felt compelled was the men who came boasting in themselves, instead of listening to them, the saints would have stood up to Paul. They should have stood against those that boasted in themselves and said, Paul is our apostle. But they didn't do that. And so he was felt compelled to do this in order for them to believe him. The work, see, it was a work of the Lord, and work together with him too. Paul had established this meeting in Corinth. And he had taken these young saints and fed them and took care of them, loving them, and he should have been a father to them. He should have had no need to boast. But them being yet babies, we read in 1 Corinthians 3, he had to set an example here. The word chiefest in this verse means to excel, as we had in chapter 11, 5. He said, for I suppose that I was not a whit behind the chiefest apostles. So we have the word chiefest again here. Even if I'm nothing, I'm still less than they are. I'm still more than they are, that's what I want to say. Even though I'm to the lowest of lowest, I'm still doing more of an apostle than they are. They claim to be some. Then verse 12, truly the sign of apostleship were among you in all patience and signs and wonders and mighty deeds. The word wrought here is interesting. It comes from a Greek word that means to work something out and to show the results of it. The word sign in this verse means to make a mark on something. Anything that would distinguish one thing from another, to mark it out. To make something outstanding, that's what I want to say. And then we have another word in this verse that kind of opens it up to us to we understand it, is the word wonder. And this is to mean anything we don't understand. It's a strange thing to the beholder. He don't know what it is. So the question may be here, did others have these signs that God has given to us? Signs of apostleship. They may have had some signs, but they were not willing to suffer. And I think that's one of the greatest signs of God's saints, is being willing to suffer. Like Paul, he had outstanding things that he suffered and will go on further. Verse 13, For what is it wherein you were inferior to other churches, except it be that I myself be burdensome unto you, was not burdensome unto you. Forgive me this wrong. Paul as your apostle being inferior to the others, they would feel that they would be inferior to other churches. And so he asked the fact, what is it that made you less than any others? Can we not come down and still be even more than they? That's the thought I think that we have there. If you can call this being inferior, but it really isn't. When they had a an apostle or a leader that isn't burdensome. It should be, their feeling should be the other way around. And I look at this and I say, in an honest statement, he asked them for forgiveness for being so good to you. I've been a burdensome. In 2 Corinthians 11, we had this statement, verse 7. He said, have I committed an offense in abasing myself that you might be exalted, because I have preached to you the gospel of God without charge or free? Is that a bad thing? Forgive me for being so good to you. Verse 14, behold, the third time I am come, I am ready to come to you, and I will not be burdensome to you. For I seek not yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. Now we have a record of but one coming, as far as we know, a direct reference of him coming to Corinth. And that's in the 18th chapter of Acts, the first three verses. But I think the word here ready explains what Paul is saying. It's an adverb with the thought to make ready. Paul had made preparation before, and now, and he possibly didn't get to come. Now he had full intentions to be there, mainly, I guess, for his collection. A minister should never become a sponge to the saints. And he says, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be a burden to you. I'm not going to take from you. Paul loved these saints like a parent would love his children, to where he wanted to lay up for them spiritual things, that is, as a parent will lay up natural things for their children and do what they can for their children. So Paul wanted to lay up things for his spiritual children. And I think he felt like, to these saints, like he did to the saints at Colossae in chapter 2, verse 7, when he said that he was gentle among them, even as a nurse cherishes her children. This is how much I love you. He was like a nursemaid to them. And then he said this to the Galatians in chapter 4:19. He said, little children, you know that he called them, whom I travailed in birth again till Christ be formed in you, how he prevailed over them in birth pains. So Paul considered that he had given birth to them, and he loved them and wanted them to understand how much he loved them. Then in verse 15, he said, I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I will love you, the less I be loved. The more abundantly I love you, over and over again, I love you so much, the less I be loved. And how much did he love them, we'll say? Well, he loved them enough to completely pour himself out for them. Verse 16, but be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile. Now this is the same attitude Jesus had, becoming a drink offering for them. They saw him as he poured himself out. And he said, but be it so, I did not burdensome myself, but in being crafty. And this no doubt words of slander that others had said of Paul. These ones that came from Judah had said, he's just being crafty. He caught you with guile. And he never would deceive anybody. He wouldn't deceive them. He wouldn't by pretending he was something that he wasn't, or that he did anything subtle. This wasn't the fact. And so I think this was kind of being sarcastic to show how foolish this sounded, that he would do such a thing. And they knew better than that. And in verse 17 and 18, he said, did I make gain of you? And this shows that what I said was true, because these next two verses back up the thought. Did I make gain of you by any of them whom I sent unto you? I said, I desired Titus, that, and with him I sent a brother. Did Titus make gain of you? Walk we not in the same spirit, or didn't we walk in the same steps? And he asks three questions here. When he was with them, did he accept anything from them? Did he try to fool them? Did he try to pretend to be something when he was with them? Did he accept any money from them? And this is something else that these false apostles was saying about him, was lying about him, that he was just there for the money he could get out of it. Then he never accepted any money from them at all. Did he try to hurt them in any way? No, he didn't. Well, did Titus? No, Titus didn't either. Did any of the other brothers make gain? No, they didn't either. Wasn't their behavior the same as mine? Yes, it was. So the answer to all these questions was positive, that he wouldn't want to hurt them. He wasn't there. Thank you that we excuse ourselves unto you. We speak before God in Christ, that we do all things, dearly beloved. Notice I called him in an interesting. Dearly beloved, for your edification. For I fear at least when I come, I should not find you such as I would, and that I should be founded unto you such as you would not. Lest there be debates, envy, wrath, strife, backbiting, whispering, swelling, tumult. And lest when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and that I should bewail many which have sinned already, and have not repented of their uncleanness, fornication, lasciviousness, which they have committed. And Paul was not apologizing concerning his conduct, but I think he said this just to establish his authority as their spiritual leader. The phrase here, "Thank you that we excuse ourselves," is progressive. It's in the progressive present tense in the addictive mood. Now this is interesting. It lets us understand what he's saying, that, and then we could read it like this, I think. You have imagined or presumed this for a long time. See how we see the progressive and the addictive mood as something, shows something that is absolutely positive, unchangeable. This is the thought. This for a long time that we would make excuses of you. This is what they taught. But God is witness, and who has a better witness? God is witness that this isn't true. It was the love of God that caused Paul to serve them, and it's the love of God that causes us to serve people today. Not for self-gain whatsoever. And we notice that he called them my dearly beloved. He has loving me. How much you really love them. What love is shown forth when we're willing to be humbled before someone and not always be right? It's better to take wrong and be humble than to be right all the time. We don't need to be right. So what if somebody gets their way? Let them have it. I'd rather be humble for the Lord. It'd be much better. He wanted them to be built up in Christ. That was his main thing. And how could they even think of any misconduct on his part? Verse 20, what I fear, at least when I come, that as a priest were saying, he would need to correct them. Contention, notice all of these things that he mentioned here. The words debates, actually has a thought of contention, strife, or be connected with anger, and heated zeal. Inward is usually the root cause of strife. Most contentions of God's people are usually connected with envy, strife, and this may be more verbal. Sometimes verbal strife is harder than any other. It's more abusive. Backbiting. That's an interesting one here, the backbiting. We just read about that in the Proverbs the other morning. That's to speak evil about those who are absent. In secret, they expose the faults of others when people can't defend themselves. Then we have whispering, and these are more dangerous than any other of this list, I think. They simply give hints of evil in the pretense of secrecy. Do you ever have somebody come to you and say, "Don't ever, I want to tell you something, don't repeat it. You won't tell anybody," and they're hoping that you go tell somebody when they got through. Well, this is what we're talking about here, the whispering. And God hates all of these things, and he said, "I don't want you to be any of these things. I don't want you puffed up as though yeast, you had your life full of yeast." You know, when things are puffed up, they got to be pushed down, don't they? Anyway, last one here is tumult. Disorder, confusion is caused when the religious voice takes control mostly. And Paul will see them in the spirit. And this is why he desired to come to them. Paul would humble himself among them. And not all the people though in Corinth was corrected by Paul's letter. And there were still many who were leaning toward these false prophets when Paul was writing this. And some of these had great influence on the assembly. But Paul wanted to see a great change in the saints done by correction, and how important correction is for us.